If you work with your hands, they don't care how you feel. You're sore, you're tired, and if the tool quits on you, you don't get to. That's the American way. And racing in Indianapolis, that's an American original. And so is Quality Supply and Tool. They're selling what works. They supply men and women who build this nation every day, not just on race day. So yeah, engines go wide open once a year, but if you're like us, you're wide open all the time. Next time you need supplies for a job, go to Quality Supply and Tool. Along with racing in Indianapolis, American originals.
Only the best run here at the Indianapolis 500.
Mario, who do you feel you'll have to beat in this year's race?
People like A.J. Foyt and Bobby Unser, for instance.
Stand by for the checkered flag.
Absolutely incredible. Danny Sullivan spun in front of Mario Andretti.
A.J. has done it. He has won his fourth Indianapolis 500.
Beyond the Bricks with Jake Query and Mike Thompson. Brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store. On 93.5 and 107.5, The Fan.
And good evening to you from inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center. It happens, hire Hensley. My name is Jake Query. Mike Thompson here as well. Landon Coons putting it all together for us. And it is hard to believe that we are already nearly halfway through the month of May, but tonight we're going to turn back the clock, and what we're going to do, Mike, you know I've been looking forward to this. You know I've been begging you for this. I've been talking about it. I've been asking about it because I want young Landon to experience the greatness for you and I, Mike, that was growing up in the 70s. You've already got a polyester suit on. You've got some of your chest hair hanging out. That's a little uncomfortable. I've got on my tough skins and my finest Pittsburgh Steelers shirt. I'm ready to go, baby.
I think this is going to be one of our best shows ever. Yeah, because when you can bring up the 70s, the tough skins. The bad part about the tough skins is my late mother, she shot for me in the tough skins, but she got it in the husky section, and I never really liked that.
Yeah, with the leather patch on the back that just said husky.
Yeah, I mean, that was a little embarrassing when you were a kid, the husky.
That's correct. I do remember the huskies well. But the good news is the huskies were fine. They just took a little longer to break in on your big wheel, right? And then once you got it going, you were good to go. No question about it. Now, I don't know if it was huskies or whatever else that people were wearing at Disco Demolition Night, but this is not a night where we are going to be blowing up records. Instead, we're going to be talking about records, talking about drivers, and taking a look back at some of the great personalities, some of the great drivers of the 1970s. And we'll begin with a guy that was really a star of the era. As a matter of fact, over the Long Beach race a couple of weeks ago, I got the chance to meet Christopher Knight, who played Peter Brady in the Brady Bunch, speaking of greatness of the 70s. And he had mentioned that his favorite driver and one of the reasons that he'd become a racing fan was Peter Revson. And Peter Revson, of course, made his debut in Indianapolis in 1969. He would race five times. He would win a pole. And there's a bit of a misconception regarding his makeup, if you will, in terms of what made him a star. Donald Davidson, the Speedway historian emeritus for the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, had that conversation and that anecdote about Peter Revson on the Talk of Gasoline Alley.
He was from a fairly wealthy family, but the stories about him being the heir to the Revlon fortune is not true. It was his uncle Charles Revson who was the Revlon man, and Peter's father, I think, worked for the company and either left the company or was in a he did not have a major position with it. I think there might have been a little bit of a rift in the family there, and then the other thing too is that Peter Revson, I don't know that we really would ever know how wealthy he was, because even if he was, and he had access to financial backing because he went to Europe in 1964, but he never flaunted it. And in fact, he drove a privately ended BRM in Europe in 1964 when he was pretty young. And he shared a flat with three other people. Mike Hailwood was one, and I can't remember who the other two were, but a little different then, that you'd have four Formula One drivers actually sharing a flat or an apartment. They call them flats over there. As far as the Speedway is concerned, he was actually entered in 1967 to drive for the Walters. He was going to drive a Dayton Steel Foundry car, and Dayton Disc Brake Special is actually how it was entered. And he drove at Phoenix, and then he ran an SCCA race on the same day as Trenton, and so he was suspended and not allowed to run the track in 67. 68 he wasn't entered. In 69 he drove for Jack Brabham. He drove the second of the Repco Brabham specials. The Repco was an engine that was based on an American Oldsmobile, and Jack Brabham drove drove one car, and Revson qualified the other. Brabham dropped out just before halfway, and Revson ran all day, and he ended up fifth, but he was down a cylinder. He didn't pass anybody, and when they flagged everybody in, and in those days still they were letting the race go 5 minutes after the winner crossed the line, and when everybody was flagged in 5 minutes later, Peter Revson was on his 195th lap, but he finished fifth. He was the highest ranking rookie, but he ended up losing on the vote. The committee voted for Mark Donahue, who finished seventh, but he'd started fourth and run third for a long time, and it was a turbocharger problem that delayed him. Anyway, Revson was back in 1970 to drive for George Walther, and he was having a hard time getting around with the Walther car, and then in the meantime, there was a problem going on with McLaren, who was there for the first time, and they had come in with Dennis Holm and Chris Amon. Bruce McLaren was here, and he drove the third car, but only for shakedowns. He never intended to qualify one, and a couple of things happened. Dennis Holm, one day, was out practicing, and the fuel cap suddenly snapped off, and it sucked fuel into the cockpit, and he was getting burns on the hands, and he had to jam on the brakes and then jumped out of the car and actually rolled along the track doing a John Wayne, and he was uninjured other than the fact that his hands were burned, and he was back to the track very soon with his hands in huge bandages. Chris Amon, fellow New Zealander, couldn't get up to qualifying speed, and so I'll never forget this a couple of auditions took place around lunchtime a day or two later, and they put Carl Williams in one car, and he got up to speed in about six or seven laps, which was his forte. Peter Revson went out in the other car, and he got up to speed in a hurry. They put Chris Amon back in. I think Revson did 166. And Carl Williams did 167 on the stopwatches, of course. And Chris Amon got back in, and he was stuck at 162. So, anyway, that's probably kind of a long story. But Peter Revson did qualify. Carl Williams was ninth with the other one, by the way. So he was the first person to finish in the top 10 with a McLaren, which is sort of a little bit offbeat trivia there. Peter Revson was 22nd. He didn't finish the race. In 71, with a completely different McLaren, the first one was based on the Can-Am car. This one looked awfully like the Lotuses of the year before. And a story we've told a couple of times, well, the short version is that Peter Revson was the upset winner to win the pole in 71. And then he ended up finishing second in the race behind Al Unser, which was not only his best finish, it was the last time that he would finish. Because in 72 and 73, although he was on the front row both times for McLaren, he was an early out. He was 31st both times. In 72-73, he was running Formula One for McLaren, and he actually won two Grand Prix, and he won the British Grand Prix and the Canadian. And there's a little trivia there, because that's 1973, which is 36 years ago. Peter Revson was the last American to win a Formula One Grand Prix. He was going to drive for Shadow in 1974 because he could see the handwriting on the wall and that he was going to lose his ride with McLaren. And then he went with the American Shadow team, was fatally injured in South Africa practicing. And then he was going to drive for Penske at Indianapolis. He was going to be Mark Donohue's replacement. In fact, they had the press release all ready to go, and he lost his life.
The man who got the ride with Team Penske that was supposed to go to Peter Revson was Mike Hiss, who had a very interesting career. Again, we hear from Donald Davidson.
Mike Hiss drove in the 500 1972 as a rookie with the Page Racing team, Tom and Mary Page. It was very much of a shoestring operation, and he qualified for the race and then made an arrangement with Andy Granatelli to transfer the entry so that it went from the number 72 to the number 60, and I love to say this one, the STP Pylon Windshield Wiper Blade Special, and he finished seventh. Anyway, he became the answer to a couple of trivia questions, and rather than pose the question, when Mark Donohue was injured in a Can-Am car in July or August of 72 and was out for the rest of the year, and so the Penske team needed a driver for the Sunoco McLaren number 66, and Donnie was that year's 500 winner and had to miss the last half of the season, so the substitute for him and finishing second in the Ontario 500 was Mike Hiss, and which I think would surprise a lot of people. And then in 74, the Donohue had retired. I was in like a managerial position, and the big question was who was going to be the driver for 1974. And there were rumors, in fact, more than that, it was going to be Peter Revson. Now, Revson was driving, had left McLaren in both Indianapolis competition and Formula One, and was now driving the UOP Shadow for Don Nichols. But he made a deal to drive for Penske at the Speedway and certain races with a view to becoming Penske's Formula One driver because Penske was coming in late 74. And the releases were, the word never went out, but the releases were all ready to go when Revson lost his life in a testing accident in South Africa. And so another driver had to be brought in. And so the trivia question is that for the 1974 500, on the pole is A.J. Foyt. In the middle of the front row is Wally Dallenbach in one of the Patrick Racing teams. But the blue and yellow Norton Spirit on the outside of the front row, who's that? Well, it was Mike Hiss, and Mike ended up finishing 40. They had a problem along the way, and so that was two times when he pinch hit for the Penske team, and then it happened again in 1978. In fact, Mike had driven the 500 in 72, 3, 4, and 5. And in 76, he didn't make it. In 77, he came back and didn't have a car to drive. And in 78, he came back again to look around and see if a ride would be available. Now, in 78, Mario was going for the world championship. This shows how times were different. He was going for the world championship for Team Lotus, having finished third the year before. But even so, he was still trying to fit in as many USAC races as he could for Penske. And this is how Rick Mears kind of came into the picture, because Tom Sneaver ran the whole season, and Mario would run the races that he could. And whenever he could not, then Mears would substitute for him. And when Mario was available, they would run a third car for Mears. Well, the plan was to qualify on the first weekend, of course, pole day preferably, but Sunday at the worst, and that the following week Mario would be in the Spa, Francorchamps, for the Belgian Grand Prix. Well, the entire first weekend got rained out. And so they thought, oh my goodness me, it's another one of these transatlantic Learjet weekends. But they were able to make an arrangement to have another driver qualify for Mario. Now, normally, those kind of things that were frowned upon, certainly for a lesser driver, but for a veteran like Mario, he's going to make it. And so they made provisions for somebody else to be able to qualify the car. Mike Hiss, I think, had already gone home, giving up on getting a ride. He gets the call from Penske, we need your help. So he came back, and then his job was to work the car up to speed. Don't break the track record, just get it in the show. Because when Mario comes back, the driver switch will put Mario to 33rd regardless. So just do four comfortable laps at whatever speed that's comfortable to get in. And so, having qualified, then Mike Hiss's duties were completed. Mario, I think, won the Belgian Grand Prix, I believe. I think he won the race and then came back to run the 500. So whether Mike Hiss left again or whether he was about to, he got yet another call. Fred Agabasian had decided to not return as the driver expert for the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Radio Network. And so Mike Hiss got the job. He's the only person who qualified for the 500 and then did the driver commentary for the radio for the same race.
That's cool.
But anyway, there's a lot of neat stories about Mike Hiss. I spent a lot of time with him, and he gave me some really good inside lines and his observations about the other teams and drivers.
Upcoming, we'll talk about another Mike who made a couple of front row starts in the 80s, even though we're talking about the 70s on 70s Night Beyond the Bricks.
If you work with your hands, they don't care how you feel. You're sore, you're tired, and if the tool quits on you, you don't get to. That's the American way. And racing in Indianapolis, that's an American original. And so is Quality Supply and Tool. They're selling what works. They supply men and women who build this nation every day, not just on race day. So yeah, engines go wide open once a year, but if you're like us, you're wide open all the time. Next time you need supplies for a job, go to Quality Supply and Tool. Along with racing in Indianapolis, American originals.
Working on building a dream space, but don't know where to start? At the Home Depot, we can help you bring your dream project to life. Whether you're building a backyard oasis, a podcast studio, or a wellness space. We've got everything you need, in-store and online. With project guides and free delivery options, it's easy to go from dreaming to doing. The Home Depot, how doers get more done.
Beyond the Bricks with Jake Query and Mike Thompson. Brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Now stay tuned for the greatest spectacle in racing.
This is the big country. Out here, you can still find places where good men have always met at the end of a long day. The men here still live a man's life every day. Even in the beer they drink. Lone Star goes all the way with the thirst a man gets when one's not enough. Lone Star, the beer every beer would like to be like. Lone Star.
Mike, one thing we can tell in learning about the 70s tonight is that Lone Star was not particularly concerned with the female demographic in terms of their beer sales in the 70s.
No, they were not. They had no interest in marketing to the female,
that's right,
female demographic at all.
I got to tell you, it's not fairly often throughout the month of May, Mike and I get together, actually, as men do at the end of the day, and we have a Lone Star because that's what a man does, right?
So that's because the brand is Lone Star.
That is correct. The brand also, by the way, the Hensley Legal Group, as in the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center. It happens. Hire Hensley. That is where we are tonight, putting together Beyond the Bricks, taking a look back at the 70s and some of the more interesting drivers, and in particular those drivers that I think our next one applies to this, Mike. Drivers that have really impressive records and made numerous starts like Mike Mosley did, who started 15 times at Indianapolis. He became a front row starter. That was at the end of his career by the time we got into the 80s itself. But we're talking about a driver with a pretty expansive resume at IMS, but yet he doesn't necessarily get talked about with some of those that he raced against when talking about mainstays of the decade.
Oh, I agree with that. I mean, Mike Mosley had a really, really interesting career. I mean, as you said, he actually started on the front row twice at Indianapolis. He won several races. People forget Mike Mosley won, I think it's 5 championship races. So, I mean, he was a pretty good driver. So Mike Mosley is a guy I think that's, as you said, I think he's overlooked, but he drove some really, really pretty cars. We'll talk about one of them on the way back, I think, the Pepsi Challenger. But Mike Mosley is definitely a guy I thought we need to highlight tonight.
Donald Davidson on Mike Mosley.
He was, and thank you, by the way, for using the term romance. I mean, I think it is romantic, or it was, and I appreciate you using that particular word. Mike Mosley came to the Speedway in 1967. And he was supposedly 22 years old. Turns out he was only 20. And he'd been runner-up. We were talking about CRA, which was Dee Jones' old stomping ground. In 1966, the top 3 finishers in CRA were Don Thomas, Mike Mosley, and Bruce Walkup. And they all came back to run Indianapolis in 67. And none of them made it the first year. Anyway, Mike drove for leader cards with A.J. Watson, and everybody said, who's Mike Mosley? Well, he ended up having 3 accidents and didn't make the race. He ran sprints that summer, and then in the spring of 68, it was announced that Mike Mosley was retiring. And we thought, but he just got here. So he came back. He was a crew member for A.J. Watson with the Zeke Lubade special, and Chuck Hose was in the car, and then Chuck Hose wasn't particularly comfortable in the car and jumped to another ride, and so who gets into the leader card Zeke Lubade special? Mike Mosley, who had retired, but he ends up finishing 8th as a rookie. Anyway, he was 13th in the 70 race. In 71, I went to 69 to 70 in a hurry, and then in 71 he had a really rough time. He crashed 2 cars trying to get qualified, and then was involved in a very serious accident in the final 100 miles of the 71 race, when he actually hit the wall and then got into Bobby Unser, and then the two of them came off of turn 4 and hit Mark Donahue's car, which had led the race pretty much for the first 66 laps or so, and was sitting against the inside wall, and the two of them plowed into that. Anyway, Mike was quite seriously injured in that. He made the comeback in 72, driving the Vivitar special, still for leader cards, and he had just taken over the lead when he hit the wall and came down the straightaway, and there was some fire. I remember him getting out in a hurry and jumping out onto the track and then falling down on the track. It was pretty dramatic. So he got some burns there. He had good finishes in other races, but the Speedway always seemed to be a challenge for him, and stuff would happen. In 73, that was the year of the great tragedy. Well, he avoided the tragedy, but he ended up not finishing the race, but he was ranked 10th because of the number of laps that he had completed. We'll just quickly run through here, because rather than do all the finishes, we want to get to the other callers, but we'll throw out Lodestar Special and Sugar Ripe Prune Special. And then in 1978, one of the most amazing things that I think I've ever seen was a driver, a great guy named Bobby Olivero, who'd been in the 77 race, but in 78 he was having some difficulties, and on the last qualifying day there was something just really kind of amazing happened. Mike Mosley, this is the Sunday morning practice, Mosley got in the car, and I think he did like 4 or 5 laps, came in and said,
it's ready, put it in line. I said, well, don't you want to run some more and maybe change a few things? He said, no, it's ready to qualify. And he went out and qualified it and did so. I think when he came in, including the cool-off lap, I think it was like his 12th or 13th lap total. And as far as hot laps, basically, I think there was like two practice laps and then the four qualifiers. That just was an extraordinary thing. He didn't finish that 1978 race, by the way, which was just that amazing qualifying run. In 1979, this could be quite a lengthy explanation, but I'll just say that he finished third and was only about two and a half seconds out of beating Foyt, who was rolling very slowly with the power gone, just barely trickled over the line. Crowd was going nuts, and Mike Mosley, we thought, had finished fifth, and it turns out there was a scoring snafu early on that had him a lap down all day, when it turns out that he wasn't. And so anyway, he just missed pipping Foyt for second in the 1979 race. And then 81, he was in the middle of the front row. I am jumping around here. 82, he was not in the race. And 83, he was in the middle of the front row. Great story about the 81 run. The story I like to tell involves a little girl. Tell you about that another time. And he was running in the top 10 when he had an accident with driving for Krakow in 83 from the middle of the front row. In fact, it was just a little bit of trivia here. In 81, he was in the middle of the front row. In 83, he was in the middle of the front row. This is Mike Mosley we're talking about. In 82, he didn't even make a qualifying attempt driving for Dan Gurney because they were having problems with their stock locks. You began to wonder, because the face of racing was changing, and what was going to happen to somebody like Mike Mosley, who was not a sponsor bringer. He was a hired hand. He was a gunfighter. And so what was he going to be doing in 84? We hadn't even heard any rumors about a ride, and then it became academic because he was out in the desert with his son, and I think they'd been motorcycle riding or something like that, and on the way back, the van got out of control and flipped over, and the son was thrown clear and still lives in the area here, but Mike, and this accident took place in California. Mike was fatally injured, but anyway, he was a very brave young man. And
Mike, you mentioned that you love that Pepsi Challenger.
Yeah, that was a beautiful car. I mean, absolutely beautiful. And Mike Mosley, people may not remember, but in 1981 in Milwaukee, first of all, Mike Mosley was great at Milwaukee, but people may not remember, in 1981 in Milwaukee, Mike Mosley started 25th in a 26 car field and won the race. I came in all the way from the back in Milwaukee. That's not easy to do. And that was a really impressive run for Mike Mosley. And Kevin Cogan actually finished second in that race. And coupled with the week, you know, before in Indianapolis, those two races really put Kevin Cogan on the map and led him to eventually getting the Penske ride. Ended up being, of course, ill-fated for him. But that actually, those two put on a show at Milwaukee in 1981.
One driver that put on several shows at Indianapolis, had a chance to win on numerous occasions, was Jerry Grant. He started 10 Indy 500s. Here's Donald Davidson with more on Jerry Grant.
Jerry Grant's best finish was seventh, but it should have been second. So I think we'll address that one first. In 1972, with the Mystery Eagle, which was a Dan Gurney Eagle, and he was Bobby Unser's teammate, and he actually crossed the line second. He always contended that he won, and it was a little difficult when somebody is so adamant about something like that to say, well, that's not true. But I think that he had been under a misunderstanding for a number of years, but he did lead. He was leading late after Gary Bettenhausen, who was Mark Donohue's teammate, led 138 laps, but was slowing down with a mechanical problem and tried to grind home to the finish and dropped out of the thicket like 182 or something. But when Gary ran into problems that began to slow down and was trying to hold the lead, but losing it and losing it and losing it, it was to Jerry Grant. So Grant took the lead, and then I remember seeing on the watching the ABC footage, like it was like maybe a week or so later. You remember when we used to it was on prime time recorded that night, but we didn't get to see it because even although it was tape delayed to go prime time nationally, it was blacked out locally.
Blacked out the entire day.
and then we would get it. I think it seemed to me that in the early years it was over the 4th of July was when we got it. And or at the very least, it would be like a couple of weeks later. But anyway, when I was watching this, Jerry Grant in this Eagle, when he came through the turns, his head was all the way over to the right. It was almost, he was so tired that he couldn't hold his head up. And of course, with the G-forces and everything, and they didn't have they just had the shoulder harnesses, but they didn't have a lot of the restraints and things. Mm-hmm. So as he came through, it was almost like his right ear was almost lying on the carpet, and he just looked tired. Well, anyway, he came in because of a tire, a worn tire, and the stop was at, let's see, was at 188. That was at the infamous lap 188. So he comes in to change the tire, and the... He was directed by Gurney and the people, and not personally Gurney necessarily, but by the team. He was directed into the next pit, which was Bobby Unser, who had gone out after 30 laps.
Yeah, that's right.
And they hooked up the refueling mechanism, and then he either got a squirt of fuel or he didn't get a squirt of fuel, so he went back out because his own supply was exhausted. And so anyway, Donahue takes the lead, and so we go home with Donahue the winner and Jerry Grant having finished second. And then the next morning, when the results came out, because in those days the results were not official, they did not even post the results until 8 o'clock the following morning, because they would go through all of the timing and scoring. They would do a complete audit overnight and get done at 3-4 o'clock in the morning or something, and then they would post it at 8, and then you had 30 minutes to protest. So when the results came out at 8 o'clock, he'd been dropped from 2nd to 12th, and the reason was, and I thought it was a fair thing to do, because they could have disqualified him completely because of the fact that he had apparently taken on extra fuel. Well, they claimed, well, we hooked up the refueling mechanism, but we didn't, no fuel went in. Well, whether that was so or whether that was not, Harlan Fengler, and I didn't agree with every ruling that he did, but I thought this was fair. It's too bad for Jerry Grant, but he said, we will disallow the 12 laps that he took after that stop. And so he dropped from 200 laps to 188, and that drops him from 2nd to 12th. But Jerry Grant, till his dying day, thought, I won the race. He was second.
Okay.
But anyway, he was a road racer, and I'm probably not doing him fair justice here, because he did have some really neat qualifying runs, and seventh in 1970 was the best finish. But he at Ontario later in 1972, with now an also Knight Eagle as Bobby Unser's teammate, he won the pole and was the first person to do a 200-mile-an-hour qualifying run for an automobile race. Now, Bobby Unser had a mechanical problem. They had 2 days of qualifying, and Bobby Unser came back the next day and was faster at 201, but Jerry Grant gets the credit, and Bobby Unser never did get over that. Mm. I mean, he was a big man, and for people that just knew him in the later years, he was sort of tall and thin. Well, he used to be tall and not thin, but he stood on the gas, and he was a very good road racer, a great storyteller, and then he ended up working for Champion Spark Plug Company, even after Cooper Industries, I think, was the outfit that owned it. But he was—he had the old Freddie Agabation position in later years, where he did the assignments for the drivers going out and speaking to the students and mm-hmm. the military bases on safety. But he had a very interesting career, because he drove in the Targa Florio as a Gurney teammate with the Cobra team, and then also he was going to run in a Grand Prix when Gurney had the All-American Races team. It ended up that Grant had no Grand Prix starts, but he was close at one time, and I think he actually appeared in a program as an engine driver in a Formula One Grand Prix. Great storyteller.
And Mike, Jerry is one of them that you got to know in his racing career and after.
Yeah, Jerry Grant was a good friend of mine. I absolutely love the guy. He was super nice to me. I mean, I was just a kid getting into racing, and he was great to me, and we'll talk more about him on on Friday night, but one of the things that I truly cherish is I have a picture of the mystery eagle that Jerry Grant signed, and he wrote to Mike from a fan of yours, Jerry Grant. And when you're a kid, you know, and that really, I mean, it still means a lot to me, just to the, what Jerry Grant wrote about me there. So Jerry Grant was one of the nicest people I've ever met in my life. That's a super, super person. Always treated me really, really well.
That is pretty cool, by the way. I can only imagine to have something like that where they say, I'm a fan of yours. But whoa, instantly would be framed, go on the wall, and admired for probably the rest of anyone's life when they get something like that, especially as a kid. All right, we come back. We will continue taking a look back at the 1970s and a couple of drivers that are always fun to talk about, but maybe we don't do so as much as we should. When we return to Beyond the Bricks.
If you work with your hands, they don't care how you feel. You're sore, you're tired, and if the tool quits on you, you don't get to. That's the American way. And racing in Indianapolis, that's an American original. And so is Quality Supply and Tool. They're selling what works. They supply men and women who build this nation every day, not just on race day. So yeah, engines go wide open once a year, but if you're like us, you're wide open all the time. Next time you need supplies for a job, go to Quality Supply and Tool. Along with racing in Indianapolis, American originals.
Working on building a dream space, but don't know where to start? At the Home Depot, we can help you bring your dream project to life. Whether you're building a backyard oasis, a podcast studio, or a wellness space, we've got everything you need, in store and online. With project guides and free delivery options, it's easy to go from dreaming to doing. The Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Beyond the Bricks with Jake Query and Mike Thompson. Brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center. It happens. Hire Hensley. Taking a look back at the drivers of the 70s and one of Mike's all-time favorite cars, as you'll hear from Donald, in the profile of Joe Saldana.
I think Joe was from Lincoln, Nebraska originally, and he was... he came to the Midwest in the mid-70s, and he actually had two 500 starts, 78 and 79. In 77, it was a real squeaker. He drove for leader cards. He qualified, and he was bumped, and he was the first alternate starter, and that one hurt. But anyway, 1978, one of my favorite car names, Mr. Wise Buys Carpet Shop Special.
That's a good one.
Finished 15th for the Hoffmans. And then the 1979, it was the KBHL Spirit of Nebraska. I don't know how I can remember those call letters. And then he was 16th in that one. And then he tried in 80 and 81. But didn't make it. So it was just those two starts. In 1976, he won the Hoosier 100, and A.J. Foyt was second. And I was not here because I was on my around the world trip at that time. But I had people tell me that he couldn't believe that. And he just, in all the interviews and to friends after, he says, I can't believe that. I can't believe I beat A.J. Foyt. Yeah. I beat A.J. Foyt. I can't believe that.
Yeah.
Anyway, he retired from racing quite suddenly, and I think he just decided that it was a good time to enter business. And then also his son, Joey Saldana, was a very successful World of Outlaws driver. Joe had several skills, and I can remember one of them was a stonemason, and the where we used to bank on Main Street, First Bank and Trust, goes back away, which originally was in the between 15th and 16th block, and then they moved down to what had been a shop at one time, and I don't even know when this would be, but it was sometime when he was driving. And so I went down there, and there were several people up on ladders working on the side of the building, and here here was Joe.
Yeah.
And we don't have 500 drivers that are stonemasons anymore, working on buildings on step ladders. But he was a great guy. He was very, very quiet. And I saw a picture of his father one time, and he was just a father and son. There was no question as to who was related to who, because they looked just alike. But he was very, very quiet. I don't know that he ever did interviews, and it's not because, I mean, he was very pleasant. He did not standoffish in the slightest, just rather shy and kind of kept himself to himself.
We left time for one more session, Sammy Sessions, Donald Davidson.
Okay, Sam Sessions was from Nashville, Michigan. I almost said Tennessee. And his tenure at the Speedway was 1966 through 1975. The best finish was fourth in 72, but I'll take you through. In 66, he passed his test with the Federal Engineering Detroit Special, made a couple of qualifying attempts, and was not fast enough to justify completing a run, so he missed it the first year. In 67, he missed it again. He was with Mickey Thompson, and he had a front engine car called Mickey Thompson's Wind Spitfire Special, and it looked like a dragster, and they never took that one to the qualifying line. He was in a few other cars as well. There was a lot of jumping around going on in those days. In 1968, he qualified for the first time. In fact, he started out with the Weinberger Home Special, but ended up qualifying the Valvoline Special for Tassie Faddis, and he finished in ninth in 68. Then in 69, he was 12th, and then in 1970, driving the Jim Robbins Special that we talked about last night, he finished in 12th again, and so he finished in the top 12 in the three races that he had up to that point. In 1971, he drove for Agajani and Foss Racers, and it was one of the Val Spinelli Jones PJ Colts from the year before. I don't know if it was the Al Unser or the Joe Leonard one, but anyway, you could see very clearly what it was. It didn't say Johnny Lightning 500 on it, but you could see what the car was. Anyway, he qualified that one and did not finish for the first time and was 27th. Then in 1972, he drove for Gene White, and Lloyd Ruby had at his disposal what they called the Atlanta Car. It was Atlanta Cars, was a company that was formed by breakaway fellows from the McLaren operation, and basically what they did was build McLarens but with another name on it. In fact, there was a little litigation about that later, but anyway, Gene White had one of those, and then they also had one of the 1972 Lolas, which were quite distinctive looking machines. And Ruby decided to go with the Atlanta, and that Sam Sessions would get the hand-me-down. And as it ended up, as they came across the line, Sessions was fifth and Ruby was seventh, but Jerry Grant was eventually docked some positions because of a pit infraction, and I'll just, rather than go into all of that, it ended up the last 12 laps that he completed were disallowed, and so he was dropped from second at the checker to 12th when the official results came out the following morning. And again, well, with the knocking down from second to 12th of Jerry Grant, that meant that Sessions and Ruby moved from 5th and 7th up to 4th and 6th. And again, the arrangement was that Ruby chose the car that he wanted, but when Sessions did so well at Indianapolis, and then Milwaukee was coming up next, apparently Ruby went over to Sessions and said, "Son, you just drove yourself out of a race car." Anyway, in 1973, Sam Sessions drove for MVS, which was a local ownership. Anyway, Sessions drove the MVS Special. Mark Bridges was the chief mechanic, and I think he was only 21 at the time, and the young youngest chief mechanic at the track that year. And the car was an early out. That was the first year for the huge wings. Then in 74, Sam Sessions drove a Smoky Eunuch. In 73, Jerry Carl had driven a Smoky Eunuch Eagle, which had a Chevy stock block engine with dual turbochargers on it. And that was the ride that Sam had for 74. But I'm not sure if the dual turbochargers were still on it or not. But he did have the turbocharged stock block engine. And a rather unfortunate thing happened, which I guess I'm dragging up, and maybe I should leave hidden. There was a situation in 74 where, because of the energy crunch, there were only two qualifying days scheduled, Saturday and Saturday. And so thinking that they would be able to fill the field within those 2 days, well, weather hampered, and that it ended up that on the second Saturday, which was the final day, weather had interfered, and the track became available fairly late in the day, and everybody's qualifying like mad, and it's a beautiful evening like tonight, and they shut it off at 6 o'clock. The very next car in line was Sam Sessions with the Orient Express, which was the Smoky Eunuch car with the turbocharged Chevy, and they never got a chance to go out. And anyway, he was a great guy, really funny, and he met a very sad end. And when his racing career was winding down, he got into snowmobile racing. And he was a factory rider for, was it Arctic Cat or something like that? And he actually lost his life in a snowmobile accident in competition.
For Mike Thompson and Landon Kunz, I'm Jake Query. Thanks for listening to Beyond the Bricks.
If you work with your hands, they don't care how you feel. You're sore, you're tired, and if the tool quits on you, you don't get to. That's the American way. And racing in Indianapolis, that's an American original. And so is Quality Supply and Tool. They're selling what works. They supply men and women who build this nation every day, not just on race day. So yeah, engines go wide open once a year. But if you're like us, you're wide open all the time. Next time you need supplies for a job, go to Quality Supply and Tool. Along with racing in Indianapolis, American originals.
If you work in university maintenance, Grainger considers you an MVP. Because your playbook ensures your arena is always ready for tip-off. And Grainger is your trusted partner, offering the products you need all in one place, from HVAC and plumbing supplies to lighting and more, and all delivered with plenty of time left on the clock, so your team always gets the win. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, visit Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.